It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the dating scene can be intimidating and a little scary, but in the last decade, we've seen a lot of new apps and websites trying to make it easier. We'll talk with a researcher of the sociology of online dating to see what the experience is like for its users. First, the Trump administration approved a plan yesterday that would allow Wisconsin to implement work requirements for people receiving Medicaid benefits in the state. It's known here as Badger Care. The approval comes at a critical time for the Walker administration as Governor Walker seeks re-election in a tight campaign against State Superintendent Tony Evers. Our next guest is here to talk about the new requirements and the political impact of the policy. Nathaniel Wexel is a reporter covering health care for The Hill. Nate, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So give us a quick overview of what the approved waiver does in Wisconsin.
Right. So basically under this, the new waiver, if you are on Medicaid in the state, if you're between the ages of 19 and 49, you're going to have to work up to, you're going to have to work 80 hours a month to keep your Medicaid eligibility. And they do have a bit of a buffer. So if you anytime up to 48 months total, then you lose coverage, basically.
And what about if you're over 50?
If you're over 50, then you get an exemption. So either you don't have to work as long or there are certain policies built into that.
And remind us, Nate, who actually is eligible to receive Medicaid?
Basically, right now, Medicaid is generally for the poorest or the sickest people in the state. And what's interesting about Wisconsin is it did not expand Medicaid eligibility under the Affordable Care Act. So if they chosen to do so, more people making more money, up to 138% of the federal poverty level, would have been eligible. But right now, it's basically people either at or below the poverty level. So this is going to affect the sickest and the poorest people in the state.
Now, poorest goes with the poverty level. Sickest could mean pretty serious health conditions that qualifies them for Medicaid. Are there exemptions if you are really physically not able to work that much?
There are some exemptions for that, and they make exemptions if you're pregnant, if you're elderly. We talked a little bit about that, but mainly if you are a healthy, able-bodied adult, they say you're going to have to work.
Now, the state originally wanted to include mandatory drug testing in addition to the work requirements. What happened with that request?
Right. So the waiver approval doesn't go as far as what Walker wanted. They are not able to drug test. But what they are able to do is basically what's called a health risk assessment. So this means that the state is going to be able to compel you, if you are on Medicaid, to disclose whether or not you engage in certain unhealthy behaviors. So if you do enough exercise, if you smoke, if you drink, all of that is now going to be into consideration.
And what has the Trump administration said about approving this work requirement waiver?
The administration sort of acknowledged that these waivers are controversial. They said they know that there is some criticism that it's basically a way to save states money and not actually connect people to work. But the administration is very adamant that work requirements are, as they say, it's a compassionate policy. So the Seema Verma, who is in charge of the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services in the federal government, she basically said, we're not going to retreat from this position. This is the fifth state to do it. We will approve more if people ask for it. It's basically full steam ahead.
And, Nate, as you said, there are four other states who have also gotten these waivers approved. How does Wisconsin's plan compare to those other states?
So what's interesting about Wisconsin is it is the only state so far that has not expanded Medicaid. So Arkansas, Indiana, New Hampshire, and Kentucky all expanded Medicaid. So their work requirements will impact people who generally make a little bit more money than the people in Wisconsin. The other thing about Wisconsin, though, is that it has this 48 aggregate month rule to get to the work requirement. So if you are not working for 48 months, then you lose eligibility for 6 months. And that's a bit more of a buffer than in some other states where it can be a year, it can be 6 months. Just if any time you're not working for, you know, a year for 6 months, then you lose eligibility.
So those other four states had their waivers approved before Wisconsin. Have there been any challenges to waivers for those other states?
Yes, there have. So right now, Kentucky actually had their waiver invalidated earlier this summer. A federal judge basically said that the state didn't listen to comments that said thousands of people would lose coverage. So they essentially basically kicked it back to the Trump administration for further review. So right now, it has not yet taken effect, but it sort of seems like it's only a matter of time before it does.
We're talking with Nathaniel Wexel right now. He's a reporter covering health care for The Hill, and we're talking about the approval of the waiver that Wisconsin requested to have a work requirement for Medicaid recipients. Now, the Walker administration has been seeking this waiver for quite a while now. Now they have it. Do we know what kind of timeline they might be on for implementation, Nate?
We don't know that quite right now. I imagine they could try to implement it as soon as possible, but it all sort of depends on the outcome of this election. As you mentioned at the top, that Democrat Tony Evers does not support this waiver requirement. So if he wins this election, he could either withdraw it or make changes to it. So right now we're sort of just waiting and seeing what's going to happen on Tuesday.
And it's interesting because, as we said, the Walker administration has been seeking this for a while. The timing of this approval a week before the election, and Evers and Walker tied in the Marquette Law School poll at 47% each. It's an interesting time for this news to come out. Certainly it's not going to be implemented before the election, but could this have either a pro or con effect for Walker?
I would imagine it could. Walker could go out in the final days of his campaign and tout it and tell his supporters, look, you know, the Trump administration finally approved this waiver of mine that I've been seeking. You know, I want to connect people to work. I want to move people out of poverty. You know, Medicaid is not an open-ended entitlement. Look at, you know, all the reforms we're doing. But at the same time, it definitely gives Democrats a lot more ammo. Democrats all across the country are running on health care. Wisconsin is no different. And they can say, look, you know, Scott Walker wants to take away your Medicaid. And, you know, that can be a pretty powerful announcement for people.
It's also an interesting time because Wisconsin has a very low unemployment rate. And so these people who are receiving Medicaid who now will have a work requirement, it might be hard to actually find a job. Is there, you know, is there any kind of training that's being put forward for to help these recipients find employment that they're suited for?
Yeah, so I have not seen a specific job training requirement or anything in the waiver that would give job training. If you are in a job training program, that counts towards your work requirements. But I have not necessarily seen anything in there that says you're required to give training to help people get a job and to qualify for this requirement.
Is this a topic that has been used as kind of a political hot potato in other states where it's been passed?
Yes, and there have been, as you noted, there have been legal challenges in Kentucky, in Arkansas. Definitely there's been a legal challenge, and it has absolutely been, a political issue. Thousands of people have lost coverage in Arkansas. Thousands of people were predicted to lose coverage in Kentucky. Advocates in Wisconsin say thousands of people could get kicked off of coverage, so it's absolutely a policy that Democrats do not like, and more or less across the country, they're willing to put it on the line and say, if elected, I will not go forward with these waivers.
I want to go back to something that we said earlier, Nate, because we were talking about Wisconsin not having expanded, taken the federal expansion on Medicaid. Guy Bolton at the Journal Sentinel actually says that Wisconsin did expand the Medicare program to cover adults with incomes up to 100% of the federal poverty threshold, or $12,140 this year. So it wasn't the full expansion that was available, but it did actually go up a bit.
Right. So it's not the full expansion, but again, it's not up to 138%. If they took the full expansion, you know, that expands the rate. So you get up to 138% of the poverty level.
And Nate, as we wrap up, what will you be watching for as we get closer to the election and after the election in terms of this work requirement for Medicaid?
Medicaid. Yeah. So really, we just sort of have to see what happens if this proves to be a policy that Walker can sell and it helps him win re-election. You know, we can imagine that we'll be seeing this get implemented very quickly. But if, you know, Evers can pull out a narrow victory, we'll sort of see if he wants to withdraw it altogether or whether he just wants to make some certain targeted changes, whether, you know, maybe he can keep the work requirement or change the premiums or, you know, make it affect fewer people, that sort of thing. But, you know, we'll have to see.
Well, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed, Nate.
Thank you.
Nathaniel Wexel is a reporter covering healthcare for The Hill. He joined us to talk about new work requirements for Wisconsin Medicaid recipients that were approved by the Trump administration and the impact this could have on next week's election. Coming up, do you or have you used dating apps? Has your experience been largely positive or negative? We talk with a guest who's studying the sociology of online dating. Stay with us here on Central Time. The idea of finding your life partner online used to seem like a crazy idea, but for many Americans, using a dating app has become pretty standard. One popular app, Tinder, has over 50 million active users as of last year, with the average user spending over 90 minutes a day on the app. While finding love with the flick of a finger might seem like an easy route, many preliminary studies are finding that things like regular rejection and navigating the overwhelming amount of choices can have some negative effects on our mental health. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you use dating apps or have in the past, what has your experience been like? Do you like online dating? Have you felt like you've been rejected a lot? Did it make you feel good to be liked a lot? And do you think it's an effective way to meet someone in today's world? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Skylar Wang is a PhD candidate who studies the sociology of online dating at UC Berkeley. In 2016, he taught a course called What Makes You Click? The Sociology of Online Dating, and he taught that at the University of British Columbia. He's also mentored individuals on online dating usage. Skylar, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, do you think the experience of users depends on which dating platform they've tried? How different are the different platforms?
Yeah, absolutely. I think different apps serve different demographics and users with varying agendas. And so, if you, for example, try an app like Grindr, which is predominantly used by gay men, it has this sort of association with hookup culture, and so most gay men use it for hooking up, whereas, you know, apps like Match.com or OkCupid or even Coffee Meets Bagel, they have this sort of association with folks who are more interested in the long-term relationships and more serious forms of dating. And so depending on the app that you're on, definitely it shapes how you interact with other people, as well as your own self-representation. And that, of course, could lead to varying forms of outcomes when you're navigating the online dating sphere.
So obviously people manage to meet and form relationships long before dating apps, long before the internet, long before computers existed. But from your research and working with people who are using dating apps, do you get the sense that dating apps are helping us in the social sphere?
I definitely do think so. I work with a lot of folks who identify as LGBTQ+, and so in sociology, we call, you know, especially when it comes to online dating, they belong to the market that we call the thin market, who are people who tend to have less opportunities to meet partners offline. And so for these individuals, online dating has really sort of opened up a new world for them to meet people. To connect with people who may not, you know, necessarily feel comfortable, say, going to the gay bar or whatnot. There are, you know, historically, there are more offline opportunities for heterosexuals. And so for them, the game is a little different, and it's a little more complicated. I think increasingly we see more and more straight folks as well as LGBTQ folks turning to online dating just because that is the norm now. Everyone's doing it, right? So in order not to miss out on someone, I think a lot of people hop on the bandwagon and it sort of joins this movement, whether actively or passively.
So with any of these apps, and they're all a little different, but basically with these apps, you have to express interest in someone and then see if they express interest in you. And even if they do, sometimes they'll just kind of disappear. You get ghosted. What does it do to us if we are putting ourselves out there and maybe expressing interest in different people and over, either not matching in the first place or not having it lead anywhere?
Yeah, I think there are definitely sort of long-term psychological effects. The thing about online dating is that the swiping and the selections are endless, right? So people have this paradox of choice that they deal with. When you're constantly getting rejected, when you swipe right on someone and you don't get the same right swipe on you, definitely I think these little, you know, tiny little rejections add up. And, you know, the design of online dating apps, I think they have to take some responsibility for that. But as well, I think for users themselves, I think it's important that they build resilience, right? That they understand that other people are experiencing the same thing as them, right? And that maybe perhaps not ascribing too much meaning to these individual rejections could be, you know, a kinder way of doing online dating. But then I also always encourage my clients and people that I help to sort of take a more open-minded approach, right? To, when in doubt, swipe right, which is, you know, say yes to someone. Because you never know whether or not you might be interested in someone. Because I think right now what the swiping mechanism has done for a lot of people is that this sort of evaluation is very superficial. Mm-hmm. You're trying to make a decision based on one photo. Some people don't even really read profiles anymore. And so I think a more open-minded and a more kind approach is to really take your time to sort of get a sense of who this person is holistically and to say more yeses than no.
I want to try to get a couple of our callers on. So let's go first to Lane in Twin Lakes. Hi, Lane.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead.
How are you? You know, my thoughts as I was just having a conversation with your gentleman that answered the phone is, you know, I've tried online dating. I started in like 2010, you know, and did it a few times throughout the year, hence like meeting someone in between. But, you know, for me personally, like I was saying, I'm a very intuitive person. So it actually caused a lot of anxiety for me because to meet somebody in person, I can actually feel, you know, have a really good, you know, kind of gut instinct sort of guidance.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't feel any of that based off of, you know, a picture or the information that people write, whether, you know, you don't know whether it's even true or not, you know, or what their intentions are. It's just a picture, you know. And I found for me personally, you know, like it's one thing to talk to somebody, you know, on the phone or through text messages and things. But when I actually had to go meet somebody, I would actually end up sick, you know, I would actually end up like sick to my stomach, you know, and for the most part, you know, to be honest with you, for me, I actually met more people that had really, really odd, strange behavior than I did to actually meet somebody who was just a normal, mature, you know, healthy individual.
And we're running a little short on time, Lane. Thanks for that call. I want to go to Sigourney in Green Bay next. Hi, Sigourney.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I have sort of a stranger take on this, I guess. I really looked out. I signed up for Tinder probably about two years ago now. But the first and only person I spoke to on there, we're now married. I just had my first year wedding anniversary, October 6th. We went to Devil's Lake for some crisp fall weather camping, but it's completely different experience, at least on my part. He had been on the dating app for over 2.5 years, he told me, before he ended up connecting with me and speaking with me. And we hit it off on our first date, had Indian food, and just really clicked.
All right. Thank you so much, Sigourney, and congratulations on your anniversary. So, Skylar, two very different experiences there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I would like to respond to the first caller. I think it's what I tell people oftentimes, you know, when they struggle with online dating or they're losing faith in the process, is that I think it's perhaps more helpful to think of online dating more as an introductory service than a dating service. Mm. So the idea is that you're really trying to just get a sense, you're trying to connect with new people, right? And then because not much of the dating really happens online. You're just trying to get a quick sense of who they are, right? Paint a relatively complete picture of, like, just have a rough, like, idea of, you know, their personality and whatnot. And then the idea is to hurry up and set up the first date and transition to offline dating, right? Mm-hmm. And once you meet that person, you know, in real life, there's no, the online dating aspect of that completely fades away, right? So the people that you meet, whether or not it's at the bar or through a dating app, they're the same people, really. And because everyone is, you know, online dating, I think really the solution here is to not give up hope and also to just be sort of more open-minded. I mean, it's love is a hard process, right? It's not supposed to be easy. And so finding a partner and building a relationship is not an easy process. So I would encourage the first caller to not give up hope. The idea that there are a lot of creeps who use online dating apps, I think, has been debunked just because everyone is using online dating apps. And so it's just about sort of managing your expectations and being better at it, right? Getting a good sort of understanding of dating literacy, for example. I think these things are more important.
And that's a great place to leave it. Skylar, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Skylar Wang is a PhD candidate who studies the sociology of online dating at UC Berkeley. He joined us to talk about the impact of using dating apps and how they can have on our self-esteem and mental health. Maybe you found yourself at a friend or acquaintance's house scanning the titles on their bookshelf. Or maybe a holiday party brought you to be mingling in someone's kitchen and you find yourself taking stock of their refrigerator decorations. Many of us like to make observations about what other people keep in their homes. It's part of the adventure of being welcomed into someone's personal space. Our next guest took that to another level. He made it his decade-long research project to closely examine our personal spaces and places where we've left our mark, from Spotify playlists to bookshelves to what's in a refrigerator. And we want to do a little experimenting today on the air. We're going to put our guest's snooping skills to the test. You can call in at 800-642-1234, whether you're at home, in your car, or in your office. Call us and describe the space you're in. Tell us about your favorite playlist, or tell us what's on your living room bookshelf or the walls of your bedroom. We'll see if our guests can squeeze out any details of your personality. That's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sam Gosling is a professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of the book Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. And he's spent more than a decade peeking in people's offices, homes, and closets to try to understand more about personality and identity. Sam, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot.
Well, first of all, I have to say, this sounds like a pretty fun research assignment. You get to poke around in people's things, look at their playlists, scour medicine cabinets, and make judgments, even mailing a box of strangers' possessions to you to take a look at. What was the research like for you as an academic snoop?
Well, it was a lot of fun. I mean, it's one of those questions that I think a lot of people think about all the time. I think it's one of those things that we are actually doing all the time. You know, we're interested as humans, we're interested in others, and we're always searching for information wherever we can find it, and people's homes are one of those places.
Do you think we just are interested in other people and their spaces and their things, or on some level are we also comparing it to ours and seeing how we stack up?
Yeah, I think we're doing both of those things. I mean, you know, other humans have always provided us with the biggest opportunities and threats. So I think we're naturally attuned to looking for information, but we're also constantly trying to, you know, figure out what's normal. That's also a very important function, being able to place ourselves appropriately within society. So we're doing both of those things at once.
What are some of the spaces, and I use that pretty broadly, not just physical spaces, but what kind of spaces do you find or have you found in your research that are the most telling about who we are and what makes us who we are?
Well, the most telling space we ever found is a place that unfortunately doesn't exist anymore, and that was in olden days before Facebook, if you can imagine such a terrible world. And there it was when people had their own websites. They would have these personal websites where they would just sort of, you know, decide, I want to tell the world about myself. And we found that when people put those up, that kind of information, and we had strangers look at those were the most accurate impressions we ever found sort of across the board.
It's interesting, though, because that's a very intentional, like, let me tell you about myself kind of situation. Whereas if you go into someone's office or their living room or their car, that's not necessarily, I mean, on some level, maybe they're kind of projecting the image they want, but a lot of it is just how they're living and who they are. So are you able to glean things from areas of people's lives that they may not actually think are broadcasting information about themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, as you are going through places, one of the important things to keep in mind is this a public space or is this a private space? I mean, I think, you know, a great example is thinking about the photos in somebody's office and just thinking about their orientation, because the very same photo could have a very different meaning depending on its orientation. If you go into somebody's office and they have photos pointing towards you, that's serving a very different psychological function than if the photo is, you know, pointing towards the occupant, him or herself, you know, where it's there, the function is for the occupant.
In preparing for this, I remember reading about diplomas on a wall in an office.
Yeah.
And if they're facing the person whose office it is, it could mean something very different than if they are clearly placed so that anyone comes in notices all of these impressive diplomas.
Right, exactly. And this is really illustrate sort of like two of the functions of the sort of object in our spaces. The first is what I call identity claims, and these are deliberate statements we make to others about our goals, our attitudes and values. We're kind of broadcasting to the world, hey world, this is who I am. It's the same thing we're doing when we put a bumper sticker on our car or we wear a t-shirt with our university or our favorite band or whatever it is. We're essentially trying to let people know about who we are, which is a very important function. And although we're doing it deliberately, there's no suggestion at all that these claims are disingenuous. I think, in fact, you know, research shows that on average, people are being honest about who they are. And then you can compare those identity claims with what I call thought and feeling regulators. And those are deliberate things we do to the environment to affect how we think and affect how we feel. And so, you know, in that case, the diploma facing ourselves, where it's not for the benefit of others, would be saying, oh, you know, it might be just remembering that time and resonating with your own identity and making you think about the ideas and the times and places associated with that, not necessarily there as a broadcasting to others. Of course, in practice, it's sometimes difficult. You don't know by the placement whether it's there for others, for the occupant, or quite possibly too, for both.
We're talking with Sam Gosling. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's the author of the book Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. And Sam, why don't you take us along on one of these investigations? Say you're going into someone's home for the first time. What is the first thing that you focus in on in trying to figure out who that person is?
Well, the first thing I focus in on is not focusing in on anything in particular too much. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes people make, is they sort of see an object, it grabs their attention, and they kind of try to interpret that very carefully. The really important thing is to look for sort of broad themes. Because let's say I go into your office and there's, you know, a blue plastic dinosaur sitting, you know, on the desk or something like that. There are many reasons why you might have that blue plastic dinosaur, and it's very difficult to know. It might be something to do with your name or like a gift from somebody or a gift you're about to give to somebody or some joke or who knows what. And so in order to disambiguate any single object, you need to kind of combine it with others. So the key thing is sort of looking around for the sort of this general impression. Is it, you know, and we found in our research is these kind of broad clues, like, for example, whether the place is sort of distinctive, like, which is a, necessarily a kind of a broad, higher level clue. It's those clues that are tend to be more valid than, you know, the single thing sitting on the desk or the window ledge or whatever it is.
Well, Sam, we asked our listeners to join us at 800-642-1234 and to tell us about the space that they are in. And let's start with Margaret calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Margaret.
Hi there.
So tell us about where you are.
Okay, I'm in my car. How much detail do you want? A lot?
Sure.
Okay, I'm in my car, and I'd just like to preface by saying it was completely cleaned, vacuumed everything 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
I have two children in the back in their car seats. I have a couple of blankets back there, a coat, a baby carrier, some artwork my daughter did. I've got a pile of books on my lap that I'm returning to the library in a moment. I have a breast pump. I have some bell peppers that I was planning to cut up once we pick my husband up and he's the driver. And various knickknacks like hairbrushes, part of a Halloween costume, and snacks.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Sam, I'm going to go out on a limb. I am not a professional, but I'm going to guess that Margaret is a parent. Just going out on a limb there. Sam, what did you pick up on there?
Yeah, I mean, so what I really want to do is like probably get a sense of sort of the nature of the books and the diversity of the books and the patterns. But there are a couple of things that come to this. And one of the things is the very important thing that you just mentioned is that many of our the things in our spaces are a consequence of the things that we do and that there are different norms. So, for example, it makes little sense to, you know, compare a parent's, room or with that of a, say, college student because they're just sorts of different standards in both terms of what they're required to do or not. So just, I mean, going on this, there were a couple of things. So first of all, the books tend to be a clue, but it would somewhat depend on what the books are and the diversity of them, to a personality trait known as openness to experiences, which is tends to be people who tend to kind of enjoy new ideas. They tend to be like abstract ideas. They tend to kind of be more philosophical versus people at the other end of the poll who tend to be more conventional and traditional and concrete.
Well, let's ask Margaret. Margaret, what kind of books are on your lap?
I actually just returned them. All of those books were children's books. Most were new ones to me. There's one about shapes. There were a couple of Dr. Seuss books, which I had read. There was an author that I'd read, but I hadn't read that particular book. It was Mo Willems' book. So all of those today were children's books, and I have an 11-month-old and a 4-year-old. So some were more geared for the no words, and some had words and pictures.
All right, so Sam.
Yeah, so I think this illustrates right the key point that I was making there. Right, is that you absolutely need to know the context in order to understand those books. Right, it's very difficult, different having a big stack of children's books for your children than it is having various works of philosophy and feminist critiques and whatever it is. So those sorts of books, of course, would be less diagnostic. It would just have less clues about the openness. One might look at things like the unconventionality of those. So if they tend to be some of the unconventional books or a broad variety, that might hint still at openness. But what it does more is it hints, I would like to see, were the books being, I would look, for example, if they were there, about were they being returned on time or were they late? Those sorts of things, along with the state of the car, would give clues to this personality trait known as conscientiousness. It's not a very good label for it. It's more about kind of dependability, reliability, levels of organization. And I get the sense from the fact that the car was very spotless and isn't now, have snacks at the ready and don't, is that there's kind of these there's perhaps a slight mismatch between the sort of aspirational self, really wanting to be organized together and things, but having, you know, having it more difficult to actually pull together in reality. So I, you know, in terms of this trait, I would say the person is probably, you know, higher in aspirations than in reality.
And totally understandable for a parent of small children. Thanks for that call, Margaret. And Sam, I would add, you know, you were talking about, are the books, you know, these very heady intellectual titles, but doesn't it also matter a little bit whether those library books actually got read or if they got taken out with the best of intentions and returned without having been opened?
It absolutely does. And that's why when we're looking at objects, you want to look at, say, well, what is the object? So, you know, and in this case, we'd say it is a book. And then you want to look at the state of the object. And the state is crucial because it tells you at the behavior. And the behavior is, you know, the real clues to personality. Has it been opened? You know, did the person get halfway through it? Does the person have lots of books where you only get to the first few pages? Are there notes in the margins? Are the corners folded over? Are there, you know, crumbs in the from where the person was eating a muffin at the same time? So, you know, essentially being Sherlock Holmes in this case, looking for what I call behavioral residue, the residue of these behaviors that have occurred. So then, so is the first thing, what is it? The second, what state is it in? And then the third is the location. And because that can also help you with the psychological function. Is it the case that kind of all the highbrow books are put out on the coffee table for all the guests to see, whereas the kind of trashy romance novels are the ones that are really read and kept, you know, away in private in the bedroom?
We're talking with Sam Gosling. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's the author of the book Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. We're learning how to be better snoops and what we can find out by looking at how spaces are organized and what's in them. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think your office or bedroom says about you? Call in and describe your music collection or your social media places. What's in your office or maybe what's in your refrigerator? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up the conversation, talking about what you can tell about someone's personality by taking a look at their music collection, their living room layout, even their favorite clothes. Sam Gosling is a professor of psychology at the University of Texas, Austin, and he's the author of the book Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. Now, Sam, you've talked a little bit about the different traits that different observations can indicate. There are five big traits. Can you give us a very brief idea of what those are?
Yeah, sure. They're called the big five dimensions of personality. The first is one that's very familiar with us, which is essentially extroversion versus introversion. That I don't think needs much explanation. The second is agreeableness, which is, you know, really picking up on this sense of how sort of sympathetic and warm-hearted are people versus how kind of direct and critical are they. The third is one I mentioned a little bit earlier, which is conscientiousness, which is really about thinking before you act, planning, making sure you don't run out of things versus people who tend to be, you know, late less task-oriented and a little more chaotic. The next one is, it's not a very good label, but it's known as neuroticism, which distinguishes those people who are kind of more uptight and highly strung and easily stressed from those who are kind of relaxed and unflappable. And then the final one is openness to experiences, which is people who are interested in new ideas and doing new things and being unconventional and creative versus the more conventional, traditional types.
Let's go to the phones, and Laura in Manitowoc is up. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that listening to this program has really made me think about something that I find kind of interesting, and that is that I've been going to a lot of estate sales in the last couple years, and I've been enjoying it to just almost a guilty degree where, and I guess I just put my finger on why after listening to your guest, but you know, obviously what I'm doing when I'm going there is I am snooping over the people's bookshelves and how they've kind of arranged their lives. And, you know, an estate sale is different than, say, a rummage sale, because in the estate sale, that person is moving on in life. They've either passed away or they're moving into a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And so their family members go through their possessions and they decide what things to keep and what things are going to be kind of dispersed just to anyone. And so there's kind of that filter that goes on where I find it interesting to see what what other people have, you know, kind of thought about that person's life and determined to be important or not important. Oftentimes you find very personal things in an estate sale, and I wonder, why wasn't that important to the family members? So I guess I've been really snooping, and now I understand why it's so enjoyable.
Thanks for that call, Laura. And Sam, that's really interesting. You do get a sense in an estate sale of it's really a snapshot of a person's life.
It absolutely is. And there it's like a single person, too. So, you know, often when we're looking at these old things, we don't know who it belongs to, and there are things belonging to many different people. And especially, you know, if it's been these things that have accumulated over a lifetime, we're really essentially seeing kind of, you know, the sort of the crystallization of all of these sorts of different elements in this person's life. And we can look at the things. We can look and say, look, this is the umbrella that has been used many times. But we can also see, look, this is the book that has been sitting there unopened for 20 years as well. So we can, you know, see both that mixture of the evidence of action and inaction and how those differ across objects is always fascinating.
Thanks so much for that call. And one thing I'm thinking about, Sam, is that, you know, many of us work in an office, or, you know, maybe if we drive a truck or a cab or something, we have a space that we work in. And often we feel the urge to decorate it in some way, to make it our own. Why is that? Why do we feel that need or urge to put our stamp on our surroundings?
I think there are two reasons. One of them is to essentially make ourselves feel comfortable in terms of, for example, matching our own level of arousal. So one way to think about it is one of the things we know about extroverts is they like people. They like, you know, they even prefer music with voices in it, and they like being around people, and they essentially have a different kind of resting arousal state than introverts. And so they tend to want lots of stimulation around them, lots of photos of people and pictures of people and so on, whereas the introverts are tending to go for something that's a bit more calming and quieting in their spaces. So that's part of the story. But another really important part of the story is telling others about yourself, because it essentially makes these interactions more predictable and more comfortable. If I think you know who I am, then I can kind of enter the conversation just with a bit more predictability and therefore comfort.
And maybe creating kind of a shortcut to making a connection?
Absolutely. And you know, many, many things in our places are there because with one single object, they convey a whole suite of values and goals and attitudes. If I have, you know, a picture of Gandhi, you know, sitting on my desk, you know, that tells you something very different than if I have a picture of a sports star or something like that. And just right there, music is also one where people love to tell people about their music taste, because just by telling you sort of a few songs that I really like, I can convey this whole suite of information about me.
Well, Sam, I wish we had more time because it's so interesting, and sorry to the callers that we didn't get to, but I think I'm going to leave this conversation looking not just at other people's things, but also at my own and seeing what they say about me.
One of the important things is if you turn the sort of spotlight on yourself, because we also know that, you know, people do make mistakes. And so understanding the sorts of mistakes people make is can be quite helpful, because you understand the sorts of false impressions people may be forming about you.
Sam, thanks so much for joining us. That was Sam Gosling, a professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of the book Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. The Wisconsin State Fair is famous for unexpectedly deep-fried things, but if you're dealing with extra Halloween candy, here's one you may not have thought of,
deep fried candy corn. I stumbled across the recipe online, and Southern Living Magazine has a helpful video if you want to tackle it. Basically, it's making fritters with baking mix, an egg, buttermilk, some cornflakes for crunch, and, you guessed it, chopped candy corn. One tip they give is that the candy corn should be fresh. I doubt if that's a taste thing. I'm guessing it's if they're stale, they'll shoot off the cutting board when you try to chop them. Here's some advice from the Southern Living Test Kitchen.
Don't worry if the candy corn's oozing out of your fried candy corn. It's supposed to. Okay, so these have just come out the oil and they are magnificent looking. You can see all the really cool colors of the candy corn coming through. And the longer that they're sitting, they're kind of developing this little syrupy glaze on the outside, which is gonna be perfect because I'm gonna top these with a little bit of powdered sugar. So for this, you just throw them into a bowl and then you just sprinkle a little bit of powdered sugar on top.
So pure sugar, candy corn topped with a little powdered sugar. I'm not a huge candy corn fan anyway, so I'm pretty sure I won't be trying this. But if you have or are going to try it, tweet us at Central Time WPR and tell us how it is. Coming next, up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about high rates of student turnover. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.